You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The last class of my old professor's life took place once a week in his house, by a window in the study where he could watch a small hibiscus plant shed its pink leaves. The class met on Tuesdays. It began after breakfast. The subject was the meaning of life. It was taught from experience. No books were required, yet many topics were covered, including love, work, community, family, aging, forgiveness, and finally, death. The last lecture was brief, only a few words. A funeral was held in lieu of graduation. The last class of my old professor's life had only one student. I was the student.
Fear motivates and restricts a lot of people from a lot of life. Plain fear. It's strange, it's unknown, it's something that might be injurious. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're getting into, and so play it safe. Mm-hmm. Stay with the familiar, with the habitual, with the known. Once you get out over your fear, you'll do anything. Go anywhere.
That was the voice of Maury Schwartz, the Maury of Tuesdays with Maury. I am Mitch Albom, the author of Tuesdays with Maury and the host of this podcast, Tuesday People, which is inspired by the writings of that book from 25 years ago when the experience took place. Alongside me is my friend and producer, as always, Lisa Goetz. Great to have you here, Lisa.
Hello, Mitch.
Lisa is broadcasting from Los Angeles. I'm broadcasting from Detroit. Both of our cities have seen significant protests in light of the George Floyd situation. And even as Lisa is broadcasting with us right now, there are protesters just a few blocks away from her home. Here in Detroit, where I am, there are protests scheduled for the afternoon and this evening. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what prompts this type of action, reaction, anger, and how it is hardly anything new. Sometimes we feel that, well, because it's happening to us, particularly if we're younger, that, wow, we've never felt anything like this before. But the fact is, this type of issue, this type of protest, this type of anger has been going on for too long a time. You can go back where we are in 2020, so go back to 1991, almost 30 years ago, Rodney King, not far from where you are right now, Lisa, and police brutality and burnings in the street and protests and things going on, a nation upset. You can go 11 years ago when there was a man named Oscar Grant in San Francisco who was just caught up in an incident on a subway, on a BART train, didn't really even do anything. And somehow, shortly thereafter, as police were razzing up people who were involved, ended up down on the ground with a police officer kneeing him in the back of the neck, not dissimilar to George Floyd, and another police officer shot him in the back and killed him. And he was unarmed, wasn't doing anything, dead. And there were protests, and there was anger, and there were calls for reform. You can go back to the 60s in 1967 in the city that I'm living in right now, in Detroit, where in August of 1967, the city half burned to the ground over confrontations between citizens, mostly African-American citizens, and white police officers. This has been going on. If you took that as a starting point, and of course, you know, before that, it was very difficult for African Americans to protest because African Americans in the country weren't even considered full citizens. But the right. issue has been going on for decades and decades. And then the reaction to it, when people get angry over things, and then what seems to be the American way of protesting is protests happen with good intent, with the point being, you know, we need to change society, listen to us, here's our point, and then somehow devolve, sometimes through anger of the protesters, sometimes through outside agitators who have nothing to do with it, sometimes with just opportunists who say, oh, great, some stores are going to be broken into, I can get myself a new television set or shoes or whatever it is. And suddenly they are unfairly lumped in with the people who are protesting for real, with something really legitimate to say. And then the issue starts to become, ah, look, they're destroying houses and they're destroying shops or destroying cities. So why should we be sympathetic to the cause? And everything gets all murky and lost when there is at its core here, Lisa, in my view, something that Maury and I talked about over and over and over and over again. Humanity. Humanity. To be humane. And as long as that is missing, we're not going to solve this problem. Now, let's talk about the situation that was just facing us, okay? Listen to what Maury said here when we were talking about what you have to do to get to the point where we won't have these kinds of differences between one another. Listen to what he had to say.
The capacity to have an I-thou relationship. Somebody else. And to be full human means, in addition, to be capable of opening your heart with love and being compassionate. Now, I've said this before in our conversations. And when we reach that stage of evolution where most of us are full human, there will not be these differentiations between black and white, rich and poor. We'll think of ourselves all as part of the human family.
We'll think of ourselves as part of the human family. Now I ask you, when you look at the videotape of that police officer, Derek Chauvin, with his knee on the neck of George Floyd for nearly 9 minutes, while people were filming him, while people were saying to him, hey, let the guy up. He looks like he's suffering. Why don't you put him in your car? It's not like he was doing this in some private moment of rage. It was public. There were three other officers right nearby. And for 1 minute, 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 6 minutes, 8 minutes, while George Floyd said things like, I can't breathe. Your knee on my neck, I can't breathe. Mama, he said, I think I'm going to die.
That was
please don't kill me. Screaming for his mother. And this man, there's a photo of him with his hand in his pocket while he's got his knee on this guy's neck, almost casual in this posture. Now, is there anything about that that is fully human? Because a human being would not do that to another human being if we all felt like we were part of the same human family. I understand the difficult job that police officers have, and it is terribly difficult. I understand that you never know what the situation is going to be, and you have to protect yourself. I understand protocol, and this is the norm when ambulances are on their way, all the excuses that are being given and will be given. But it doesn't erase the lack of basic humanity. When a person is suffering, and you are causing that suffering, and the suffering is not necessary, humanity and being human and part of the human family would say to you, I need to stop, right? What I'm doing here is wrong. This man can't breathe. Above all, for a $20 bill, remember what was at cause here, in case you're new to the story. The whole cause, he wasn't being accused of being violent with anybody. He didn't pull a gun on anybody. He wasn't threatening anybody. He was accused, I don't even know if it's been proven accurate or not, he was accused of using a false $20 bill, a fraudulent $20 bill. Now, that can happen to any one of us, by the way.
Right.
I've had that happen. $100 bills, $50 bills, where they say this isn't good. I say, oh my God, how did I get it? Somebody gave it to me. That is hardly a crime that puts you down in the street as some kind of dangerous criminal with your hands cuffed behind your back and still with the knee on your neck. You don't do that to another human being. I don't care if you're a police officer or not. You understand what I am? I being clear on this with you, Lisa? Because I hope with the audience I am.
Yeah, no, it's really it's hard to watch. It's hard to even hear you talk about it again. You know, when I think about it, and you're right, he may not have even known he had that $20 bill on him. It's not like he had a printing press in his basement and they uncovered this and then they finally caught him. And in which case, that still wouldn't warrant this. Nothing warranted this. You know, it was just the hardest thing to watch.
Well, nothing warranted it, and that's why the excessiveness, that's why people assume that it must have had to do with race. Now, we don't know for a fact that this cop wouldn't have done the same thing to a white suspect. We don't know. It would have been just as wrong. An Asian suspect, a woman, it doesn't matter. As Maury was saying, if you don't think of yourself as part of the human family, if you make differentiations between, well, there's me and there's other people, whatever that me and other people there is, and that doesn't just mean black and white, that can be male and female, that can be sexual orientation, that can be religious orientation, that can be foreigners. As long as you make a distinction between yourself and other human beings, you're excluding people from your family, the human family, then you are capable of doing almost anything.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Here is Maury again. Here's the reason I'm playing a lot of clips today is I want you to remember, ladies and gentlemen who are listening to us, this was 1995 that Maury and I were sitting together. 1995, 25 full years ago from today, and it is as if nothing changed. And he was frequently talking about stuff that happened in the 60s when he was on campus at Brandeis University, which was kind of a hotbed for activism back then, including civil rights activism.
Right.
So listen to what he says about why people look to blame other people when society gets fearful. Because remember the context of where we are here now. We're in a very splintered country, politically, under the Trump administration, and there was a lot of it under the Obama administration, we have cleft ourselves in two in such a way that no one can recall, short of the Civil War, us being so politically divided. So we're divided. We're scared. Now comes coronavirus, and now people don't know even to trust the people who look like them and are their neighbors. We can't be around them. All of a sudden, you've got all this pressure on people, and what happens? You look for a scapegoat. Listen to Maury talking about this in October of 1995.
When things get tight, you always look to blame somebody. So you blame the black criminals, or you blame the black mothers who have kids out of wedlock, or you say they're taking unfair advantage through affirmative action. You're looking for a scapegoat, and they're not finding the right one, the right scapegoat, and the right point, the thing, the place to point your finger is the greedy corporations. But people are blind to that insight. They want more and more and more. Everything is the bottom line. And these poor individuals are made scapegoats for corporate greed.
Now, the corporate greed point aside for the moment, we can do 10 shows on that because things have not improved in that area since 1995. No. But looking to blame somebody, that's another thing that's going on right now. Everybody is looking to blame somebody involved in this. Now, the police force is rightfully, in my opinion, being targeted as, you know, how could they allow something like that to happen? But I'm sure there are good cops on the Minneapolis police force somewhere. I don't think this is systemic that everybody's like this guy. I mean, I hope to God nobody else is like this guy. But sadly, we've seen so many cases of this that you can't really say that for sure. But there are people who want to blame every cop, every police officer, right? That's one group. Then there are people who are blaming the victim. Well, you didn't have to resist arrest. I didn't see much resistance. I saw most of the video, and for a guy who looks like for a guy who looked like he could have knocked out all the police officers involved, he's a very big guy. He allowed himself to be taken from the car. He was handcuffed. I don't know what he said, but I don't care what he said. I don't care what comes out of somebody's mouth. When you have somebody handcuffed, he is subdued. What's he really going to do when he's handcuffed? And then you get him down on the ground, and then on top of down on the ground, you've got to put a knee on his neck. There's no so. But people are blaming him, blaming George Floyd, and saying, "Well, if he just would have been nicer about, you know, or if he wouldn't have used that $20 bill in the first place, if he would have not resisted arrest, then as if it's his fault, looking to blame somebody, right? Then there are people who are now blaming the protesters." Well, you see, this is what gets agitated. They're breaking into stores, they're looting. And of course, these people who are looting and who are committing violence are not honoring George Floyd. And it's not justifiable. And most of the responsible leaders in the African-American community are saying the same thing. They're saying, what are you doing, including his family?
But they're also, we have to separate them from the protesters.
Right.
And you have to separate the two because it's unfortunately taking the spotlight away from these people whose hearts and souls are in these protests.
That's right. That's right. And really, they shouldn't even be called protesters. They should be called opportunist looters. But everybody is right. But they're looking to glom onto that. And of course, if there are any African Americans in that group, then there are people in the country who say, "Well, look, African Americans are committing these vandalism crime. So how are we supposed to be sympathetic?" It all goes back to what Maury said. Everybody looks to blame somebody, to blame people who aren't like you, instead of trying to find the humanity and the common good that we have together, the ways that we are more alike than we are different. Now, Maury was, as I mentioned, no stranger to social protest. You could not be if you were on Brandeis's campus in the 60s. There was just no way. First of all, it was the Vietnam War, and that was one of the biggest things they were protesting, but all kinds of civil rights and other issues. Brandeis was a hotbed. Jerry Rubin went there. Angela Davis went there. Abby Hoffman went there. So, you know, that's like a pantheon of 60s rebels. and they were Brandeisians at some point in their college careers. And so he saw quite a bit of protest, and in fact, he supported the protest. And he would say to me, he said, "You know, I saw a lot of kids who didn't know really what to do, and they were a little lost. But I felt that I could support them and help them not make mistakes, protest responsibly, do the right thing." But he said he liked the fact that they were engaging in activism of some kind. Because it's a lot better than being passive and just having no thoughts about anything. And I think about a percentage of our college kids today who just want to play Xbox. So I'll go to college, I'll play Xbox, and I'll be done. So which really is better, to go to a march about the environment or about justice or about civil rights or things, or to play Xbox? But here was Maury talking at one point when we visited one another, again, 1995, about protests and when they are effective and what are some of the challenges for them to be effective. Listen to what he had to say.
I think if you have a good cause, a large protest is a good way to start doing the hard work. You get a lot of energy and enthusiasm, and hopefully you can carry on from there. The whole problem is motivation. People have so much to do. They carry on double jobs. They have families. They have their backyard they have to keep planted. And on and on. When are you going to find time to protest? So you really have to be motivated.
Now, I read that, listened to that, and I found it very interesting because I believe one of the reasons that the protests are as strong and as widespread as they are is directly related to the coronavirus pandemic. Because this is happening during a time when people are not allowed to get together. It is technically illegal in some of the states where these protests are happening for that many people to gather. But people are seeing that, oh, well, we can protest. We can get together at a protest and you don't get in trouble for gathering. Let's go. And there's a certain enthusiasm to gathering, and people aren't working. They're home. They're not racing off, as you heard Maury said, doing double jobs, keeping their gardens planted, all that. They have the time right now. And so if someone wants to organize a protest at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's not a barrier like it would be on a normal Monday or Tuesday or whatever, right?
Right. And also, I think that we've all been tea kettles just boiling for the past 3 months. And with, you know, being cooped up in your house and not being able to go out and not being able to do anything. And then something like this happens and everybody's got such anger and passion and everything about it. So they're taking to the streets. And I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen all of the protests going on, but I know here in Los Angeles, it was a striking number of people who were not wearing masks and shouting. And I'm having this nightmare scenario of 3 weeks from now having another outbreak. And I just think being cooped up and not to mention so many people are out of work, which is causing such stress to people and such strife. It has been the perfect storm. This could not have happened at a more imperfect time.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. It's the timing of this is very unfortunate. And yeah, we don't even realize what the physical ramifications of this might end up being in some of the states.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face-Off launches April 9th.
But there's no question that, as you correctly point out, Lisa, the emotion has stirred people, the lockdowns, and then suddenly, well, I'm not going to be locked down anymore. This is too important. You have a feeling of, I have a reason to be out there risking myself. That's a big motivation for people as well. And,
Constitution trumps any sort of local laws, right? Our right to assemble. It trumps everything. So we're allowed, right? I mean,
yeah, well, that's right. I mean, if you're talking about the basic American principles, getting together for something like this, you don't see people being arrested because they've exceeded 50 people or 10 people or whatever the number is. And so I feel for all the parties that are involved who are trying to keep peace, both the protesters and the police, in addition to the fact that nobody wants to get that close to anybody. You know, the police are not in a hurry to be arresting people and having to get close to people they don't know. They're risking their lives. You know, they've already been risking their lives. And I find it very interesting. 2 weeks ago, no, 2 weeks ago, 6 days ago, police were on everybody's front burner as first responders. We love them. Wonderful what they're doing. You know, we always forget how much we appreciate the police and fire people and first responders. And now all of a sudden, they're being vilified because of one person's issue. Now, we should say that this was one really bad cop, one really bad issue person. It is emblematic of issues that have gone on and on and on and on. And that, of course, touches back on the issue of race. And this is a difficult, and I should say it right here, I'm Caucasian, Lisa's Caucasian, if you didn't know that when you were listening to us. And I always feel that if you're going to talk about race, you have to immediately say, listen, this is from an individual perspective. There's no way that I can feel what an African-American feels when they look at that image. As disgusted as I am, as brokenhearted as I am, as I, when I saw it, I couldn't even stand up. I watched it again and again, but still, it's not the same as thinking that could be me, that could be my son, that could be, you know, anybody who I know who is in my family who happens to have this skin color. And so there's no way to understand that, but that should not stop people who are not African-American from being empathetic and trying to express support, because otherwise you say, well, I can't address it. I can't speak to it. I'm not black. Well, that's not right either. You know, wrong is wrong. And if we're going to talk about being in this human family that Maury mentioned, then you absolutely have to talk about it. But there's the issue of race. It goes back and on and on, and it'll probably go on for many, many more decades to come. Maury and I spoke about it during our visits on Tuesdays, and I remember we were talking about some of the problem and some of the antagonism towards African Americans even back then, even in the fall of 1995. Listen to what Maury was saying to me in just a conversation that just happens to be pertinent today.
There's still a lot left over prejudice and hatred and wanting somebody to be subservient to you. Why? Because you are such an immature, small ego. It's all about, much of it has to do with not feeling enough of a full human being, a mature human being. So you look for somebody to put down, to be superior to you. Black people are right when they say most whites are racist. Even if they aren't racist in their actions, you think of a black person, really a rare person, doesn't make the distinction between black and white. And somehow or other, making the distinction, saying you're a little better.
So it's hard not to feel that when you look at that image of the white police officer looking so indifferent to George Floyd with his knee on his neck. But we also need to remind people that that is one bad person, and one, I don't even know what word I could use. Just insensitive is such a weak word. Inhuman maybe is better, but that is not everybody. And I do think that we have made progress in race relations since 1995. I do think that as young people don't make the distinctions that older people do, and it's not the issue to them that it is, and dating and cross cultural musics and things like that, dressing, all that, the differences are, if you talk to any kid, it's just not as big an issue with them as it might have been in our generations or for our parents' generation. So I do think there's some progress there. But I understand why African Americans will always assume that someone looks at them and a white person looks at them and says to themselves, makes the distinction mentally, African-American person, white person, just as I think, by the way, people do with when they see Hasidic Jews who are dressed, you know, in long dark clothing and beards and whatever. They're very visually distinctive. Oh, well, that's an Orthodox Jew. That's different than me. Or when you see the Amish people who clearly are easily identified, or Asian Americans or Native Americans, people do that. I think that's almost sadly part of human nature, right, that we can't get past, is that, you know, we immediately think that's a person that's different than me, right? You want
to your brain just categorizes, I think. You know what I mean? Your brain just automatically categorizes people, whether you, as Maury said, you're conscious of it or not, whether you're racist or not. You know what I mean? There is a certain categorization that takes place.
Right. And so I asked him right after he said that, I said, well, how do people correct that? If people are sort of wired to recognize differences and to look at someone and say, that person's different than me, that person's black and I'm white, that person's white and I'm black, that person's Asian and I'm Native American, whatever the case may be. And here was his answer.
By self-consciously watching when you do it and saying no to yourself. There have been times when I felt this person was rude to me. And it was a black person. I had this reaction. Yeah, it's a black person being rude to me, rather than this is a person being rude to me, regardless of its color. Mm. But it's built in, you know, and you got to build it out by continuing recognition. So that now I really recognize black from white. And after a short while, I forget all about it. Mm-hmm. So it takes a matter of effort and discipline, no doubt about it.
So what he's saying here is you have to consciously do some work. You are wired a certain way, just like we're physically wired a certain way. It would be nice if you could, you know, eat pizza every day and then get up and run 10 miles and there would never be a problem, but it doesn't work like that. And so you've got to condition yourself and you've got to stop eating the pizza and you've got to slowly work your way up to the 10 miles and all that. That's a simplification of the issue. But the point is, if you are already pre-wired to sort of start to recognize people's differences, you've got to unwire yourself. You've got to say to yourself, am I angry because I'm making an assumption of that person's skin color or that person's religious garb, if they're dressed in Muslim hijabs, am I immediately making some kind of assumption about how they're acting towards me? And you've got to unwire yourself from that. You've got to say, stop, before I make a judgment, let me put myself through the ringer. Let me not put the other person through the ringer. Let me put myself through the ringer. Would you say this if you're, I do this a lot as I've gotten older, would I say the same thing if my brother, who is my brother's a vocal person, he expresses his opinion, and I love him, you know, and I find it can sometimes be acerbic and other, but I find it funny, and you know, it doesn't bother me, but I'll ask myself, well, if what this person just said to me, if that was my brother, would I say no problem, no issue, and am I taking offense because it's not a member of my family, or doesn't look like me, or doesn't act like me, and try to put myself through that ringer and substitute someone I know and care for into the same action that the person did? And then would I treat my brother that way? Would I treat somebody that I love the way that I'm feeling right now? Now, I'm pretty sure that if this officer in Minneapolis had gotten a call about someone trying to pass a $20 bill, and he showed up, and it turned out to be his next-door neighbor's son.
Right.
I'm pretty sure he'd never be there with a knee on the guy's neck, right?
Never.
I doubt he'd ever even handcuff him. So clearly it makes some kind of difference. You're making some kind of an assumption about someone that you know versus someone that's a stranger to you. And then it's just a short distance to, well, someone you know versus someone who's a stranger to you, someone who's a black stranger to you, or a different color, skin color as you, a different religion than you. And you allow yourself to become desensitized that much more at each level takes you away from who you are. And this goes back to what Maury was saying at the beginning. If you think of yourself as part of the human family, then there won't be that distance. Every person you judge will be one of your brothers or your sisters, right? And you won't have that differentiation.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
So I asked Maury, what could we do about this? This was less than 2 months before he died, Lisa. And I read these things over and I just see it's crazy. And he was not happy about what was going on in the world back then, just 2 months before he died. And he was worried about the future of our society, our American society. And here's what he had to say when I asked him what he saw for the future.
Everybody's frightened, distrustful, ready to do violence. What does that mean? Either anarchy is going to reign, or you're going to have a military state, you know, where it's martial law. Mm-hmm. Now, I've never felt that before in my 78 years, or 70 years of a consciousness. But I am really concerned. And a lot of it has to do with just simple disregard for the basic human dimensions of things. You never hear on the media, what is the importance or relevance or significance of this law, idea, principle for individual human beings? Who cares? That's really the whole issue. So the answer is making a caring community. Now, it's not easy, but if you have that objective, you can start to work on it.
So here he was 2 months before he was dying, and he's saying, we're going to have a military state or martial law, which there are parts of the country right now and cities in the country that looks pretty darn close to that.
Heck,
and he
yeah.
said, yeah, simple disregard for the basic human dimension of things. Isn't that what we're living through right now? Simple disregard of basic human dimension, basic humanity of another human being. And as I say, this was back in the 90s, and you could go back 30 years before that and have the same discussion, 30 years before that and have the same discussion. So if the problem isn't new, then the problem is that our solutions to this point have not worked. And trying to legislate our way out of this, you know, like I said, I wrote a piece about this on Sunday. And I said, well, so what can you do in a situation like this for this particular police event? Well, you can legislate. You can outlaw chokeholds and things like that that are still allowed in police department maneuvers right now. You can eliminate the blue shield, as they call it, you know, the kind of cops protecting other cops. And not ratting on one another, you can eliminate some of the legal hurdles there are, and I won't get too deep into the weeds, but there are a lot of legal hurdles to try to convict a police officer, because the way the laws are written right now in some Supreme Court decisions, there's sort of almost a tilted playing field in terms of a police officer's right to presume that things are going to go bad or et cetera, et cetera. It's really hard to prosecute police officers. You could do all these kinds of things and change all these kinds of laws, but you can't legislate humanity. You can't pass a law that just says you must have common decency in dealing with other people. And this was just a simple fact of just common, whatever was in that guy's heart. There was no law that was going to change that. To be that insensitive and to allow people to film you and make comments, he's fine. And see how ridiculous you look with a knee on another person's neck for 9 minutes and to not have any regard. It's an animal. You wouldn't treat an animal that way. I shouldn't even say that. You had less regard for him than he would have for an animal. It was very close to squashing a bug. There is no law that you can pass to make people have humanity.
No, but I blame also the other three cops that were sitting there. They had no humanity either, because they were the only ones in that group that could have stopped him from doing that. And nobody stepped forward to do so. And so none of those people were doing anything that you've been saying, which is look at this person as a relative. Look at this person as your brother. Look at this person. They were looking at it as protecting another cop. And all of what you're saying right now and all of what Maury said came into play here. And boy, we have a lot of work to do. You know, we have a lot of work to do. I don't know if it'll ever change. Let me say one other thing too. This guy had what, 18? Was it 18?
Yeah, prior.
Different complaints against him that clearly, and two of which were taken seriously prior to this. He should have not been out there anymore. I would say just like a criminal three and you're out. You know what I mean? Like if you can't be a humane cop. And by the way, I bet you it's really hard to be a cop and to not see all the stuff you see every day.
It's extremely,
you know.
Yeah. And nobody reports on all the good things that they do and all the bad things that they see on a daily basis and have to put up with on a daily basis and the tolerance that they have to show when they probably, you know, if you were in that same situation, you'd have lost your tolerance a long time ago. And the history of maybe they've got friends who have been attacked, shot, killed over the smallest of things. So, no, I have, just as I said before, there's no way I can put myself in the shoes of an African-American man. There's no way I can put myself in the shoes of a police officer and what they have to deal with and what they have to do.
No,
and never. I'm not going to. But I agree with you that the other three had a human obligation to step in and say, you know, I don't care if we're all police officers here. First, we're human beings. And until we start to think of one another as human beings, there's a part of me that wishes it would be a science fiction movie. This would be a great Twilight Zone where the whole world all of a sudden woke up and everybody's skin was ripped off. We all functioned, we all moved around, but you just saw like the veins and the whatever, and you couldn't tell who was who anymore. You couldn't tell, you know, everybody was just what do they call the chart, the biological chart that you see in your classrooms when you take biology, or you see in a doctor's office, you know, where everybody was just the inside and everybody had to walk around. Would all this go away? Or would we find a way to say, oh, his veins are skinny and, you know, my veins are thick and we're going to separate into
the skinny people. Yeah, look at how red her muscles are.
Yeah. We'll leave you with this thought, because I asked Maury, okay, so what do we do with this? You know, what's the way forward out of this? And perhaps there's a little bit of hope in this sentence here.
I really believe, even what's going on, that the road to survival is to take responsibility to and for each other, for the physical environment, with compassion. Otherwise, we're sunk, because you can't carry on a complex society such as ours, just on the basis of impersonality and divorced from concern about the well-being of the other person. It will break down.
So let's hope that ours does not break down. Let's hope that some of the wonderful examples of common humanity that we have seen in the COVID-19 thing, where people have come together to try to help one another, that type of humanity will rise to the surface here. Let's hope there's some action that comes as a result of this and some healing. But let's try to remember we all are part of that same human family. And really, without that, there's no way you can prevent a situation like this occurring again. But with it, it won't happen again, because you wouldn't treat a member of your family that way.
Or as my mom always put it so eloquently, be nice.
Be nice.
Two words.
We do this podcast
just be nice.
Every Tuesday, and we're glad that you were able to spend some time with us in the Tuesday People podcast. We wish you a good, safe week, a quiet week and a loving week with the people that you care about, and hopefully a peaceful week for this country. Until next time, on behalf of Lisa Goich, this is Mitch Albom saying, we'll see you next Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to Tuesday People. To be part of our conversation, join the Tuesday People community at WeTuesdayPeople.com. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode, and share it with your friends. We look forward to having you with us every Tuesday because, after all, we're Tuesday People.